It is Saturday, June 24th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, after a Geek News Spot, we're speaking with Editor-in-Chief of Make Magazine.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our show, we are speaking with Mark Fraunfelder, the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine, all about the cool things people are doing with technology. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation with questions and comments about technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment, crowns, and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into our discussion about Make Magazine, which is very cool, let's go ahead and go into the geek news of the week. I think I'll start with you, Mr. Cleveland.
NASA will be sending flies into space on July 1st.
As in the insect?
Yes, fruit flies, 100 of them, male and female.
What are they doing?
They'll be floating in a container.
Cool. Next,
I'm assuming this is for genetic research.
Actually, flies, it seems, have the same ability to fight off infection, the same immunity that humans do. So what they're going to do is study their ability to fight off bacteria, which can mutate, become more powerful in a gravity-less environment.
Okay.
And or microgravity. Yeah.
Microgravity environment. And you're going to also just watch. I guess what they're trying to do is prepare astronauts for longer journeys, let's say to Mars. So they need to understand how our immune system works in space and what can be done to fight off
some of these problems. So they're going to release some bacteria with these flies and see what happens.
I don't know if they're going to release bacteria. They didn't say that.
I think it's exciting we're setting another shuttle up. Thank you for that. Mr. Elam, hi.
Hi.
Man, you stepped in here, the skin of your teeth.
Miles, right?
Oh, yeah, Miles. So, welcome. Welcome. What's up in the geek news thing?
Well, embryonic stem cells have been used to help paralyzed rats walk again. Or move again. They're ones that were...
No, we talked about this before on reconstructing the main spinal column on mammals.
Right.
Was it rats before? Was it a different...
No, it was rats or lab mice.
But they got it to grow. Now they're getting it to
walk.
Well,
what they had done was before they had just bridged a damaged spinal cord. But now they're actually using it to regrow the circuitry needed to move a muscle. So actually helping them to walk, not just... getting sensation and having some movement.
Or seeing cells repair. Okay, so they got a quadriplegic or paraplegic rodent to be okay again.
Or at least very well on the way.
Wow.
I mean, obviously it's going to be like someone who has brain damage or some injury. You need to relearn how to use those things, but you need to have the actual nerve pathways before you can do so. And here's an area where embryonic stem cell research is actually starting to bear fruit.
Great. Now, of course, that's in rodents, not in humans. I'm assuming no humans.
Although there are many physiological similarities between mice and rats and human beings, which is why they're used for a lot of research.
Okay. I've got a news story. Thanks, Miles. It looks like the broadcast flag has suddenly reappeared in a telecom bill. So,
what is a broadcast flag, Lyle?
You know what? Let me ask you that, Miles, because you are more knowledgeable on the subject. What's a broadcast flag, Miles? How about it's a way of enforcing copyright through technical means? Is that good?
Yeah, it's tagging copyrighted content.
Sure. So the amendment in question covers both digital TV and radio and would allow for the kind of draconian regulation the content creation industry has championed all along. I don't even know who that quote's from because I didn't read the article, but our illustrious Dee Dee Hubbard from New York sent it in, and it's important that we pay attention to the laws that might affect our lives.
Well, it's the equivalent of when you're recording something off of TV, like on a VCR, and it can be copyrighted content, but according to copyright law, like, you can make a backup of it, or but you can't redistribute it. You can't try to sell it again. You can't do, like, public appearances with it. That's one of the give and take of copyright law. Whereas what's going on with the broadcast flag is you'll have TVs, DVDs, VCRs that if copyrighted content has this flag on there, the player or a recorder wouldn't actually record it, wouldn't allow you to do it in the first place, even if your actions would be falling under what has normally been considered fair use.
Sure. All right. Thanks. Sean, hi.
It's really going to be interesting to see how all this plays out.
Yeah.
Especially since, I guess, Toshiba will be launching their HD DVD recorder in Japan. It's the world's first for approximately $3,500.
So it's like the first VCR, huh?
And that's the HD DVD, not the Blu-ray.
Correct.
Okay.
Oh, so it's a burner as well.
Yes, it's a recorder. It's a consumer recorder, like your a home DVD player console. Mm-hmm. Not talking about a computer drive. We're talking about with a hard drive and
$3,500.
You know, like a TiVo replacement. So, IBM and Georgia Tech have made a silicon germanium chip run at 500 gigahertz.
Oh, that's fast.
Breaking a record.
The chip or just a transistor?
The chip. They made the chip run at 500 gigahertz by dropping the temperature to minus 451 degrees Fahrenheit.
Talk about a cooling system in your machine.
Yeah. So to get that fast, you need extreme cooling. But at room temperature, it'll still run at 350 gigahertz.
What's that?
Which is compared to what we have now? Well, you can buy a 3 gigahertz processor on the store shelves right now.
And maybe overclock it to 3.5, right?
I don't know. If you're lucky. So
300 at room temperature. Now, is that a whole chip with lots of...
A 350 at room temperature.
Is that a whole chip with a whole bunch of transistors? Because we've heard about these transistors running at that speed.
Presumably, the transistor count's a lot lower.
This is silicon that they've done this experiment with. Mm-hmm. And this silicon has germanium sprinkled on it. IBM's been selling these types of chips to the cell phone market since 1998. Intel has been adding minute amounts of germanium to create their strained silicon that is currently in processors today. But they're, of course, this technology is just, is more mature and they're finding new ways to push it. And what this shows is in the future, there will be ways to push, you know, the silicon, which what, you know, microprocessors are made of, to faster and faster speeds.
As long as you have liquid nitrogen or liquid hydrogen nearby.
I mean, they did that at room temperature, but yeah, when you're talking about a stacked chip, you know, that's a nice size and is running all the time, it's going to be interesting to see where we go in the future with regards to heat. It's a big issue right now.
Thank you very much, Sean. Miles? You know what? Let me leave it up to you guys. We got time for one more news story. Who wants to do it?
So something else is interesting.
I guess that answers that question.
Yeah. Sean, go ahead.
I don't know if you remember back in 2004 when Intel made their big announcement about the BTX form factor. Remember that?
Yes, right. The new type of...
I don't remember.
Not very
that,
many people know about that. So the whole idea was the BTX case was supposed to replace the ATX. So ATX motherboard is a form factor. You can go buy an ATX case. It'll fit your ATX motherboard. It
if
all
you
goes together.
A computer in the last 10 years, it's probably been an ATX.
But it doesn't make a lot of sense because in an ATX case, your power supply is on top.
Which is silly.
Because all the heat rises into the power supply. Yeah, that's silly. Your CPU is, you know, right there in the middle up close to it. That's not good. It should be closer to the bottom of the board instead of the top left part of the board. The memory DIMMs, you know, are next to the CPU, blocking airflow into the CPU. Yeah, there's just the board design wasn't smart, and BTX was supposed to fix all that by moving the processor closer to the bottom, lining up the memory so that airflow's through the memory.
Instead of over it, right? Yeah.
So, the memory is actually at the bottom, the processor, and then your cards. So it completely flips around everything, and your power supply is at the bottom of the case.
What happened to BTX?
You know, it's just like x86. Yeah, nobody wants to move to something new, you know? You buy a motherboard, or you buy a case. Nobody expects to buy a new case for a new form factor. They want to know that
they can plug it in.
They can buy a new motherboard, and it'll fit into their existing case and have to spend a lot of money. Companies like Dell, though, have been shipping BTX. So system builders have been pushing this.
So it doesn't exist out there.
It's just very slow. So the adoption rate right now is 24%. And Intel started pushing this in 2004. It's taken this long to get to 24%.
I got to play devil's advocate, though, because I'm remembering what was there before ATX came out. And ATX was a huge improvement over what was there before. Yeah. So
you'd like BTX to exist, or?
Well, BTX is great, but it was saying like ATX was a bad design. Well, it was just incremental from what was
there.
There
are different flavors. There's BTX, micro BTX, nano BTX, pico BTX. They're all for different things. If you want to make a home media center, you know, you'd get the small one.
If you can't tell, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. With me in the room are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. We've been talking about the week in Geek. A magazine by geeks and for geeks. Make Magazine is chock full of people doing cool things with technology and instructions on how you can too. Mark Fraunfelder, editor-in-chief of Make, joins the geeks right now for a bit about the magazine's current issue. Mark, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks, Lyle. How's it going?
It's going well. We've been enjoying a discussion about BTX form factors. And since we're going to be talking about your current issue, why don't we go ahead and talk about the whole thing about making, building out computers, which you've got a little thing about in your current issue.
Oh, you're talking about the own your own section where we talk about the different things you can do to a tower PC?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a cool little feature.
Yeah, this is going to be a regular feature in the magazine where we look at different kinds of personal technology and show people how they can actually modify and adapt the technology to suit their purposes. It's kind of a retro look at technology when, you know, in the older days, people were expected to be able to open up and repair the stuff that they had on some level. You know, old TV sets used to come with the schematics and a little envelope in the back of staple to the board.
Yeah, in the case even. You could open the case up and you'd find it. Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's disappeared in our throwaway society.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I remember, you know, when I was younger, if our television set started to look funny, my dad would pull the tubes out of the TV, and I'd ride down to the drugstore with him, and there was this machine in the corner, and you would plug the tubes into the machine, and there was a little meter with a needle, and it would tell you the condition the tubes were in, you know, if they were okay or they needed to be replaced.
And this lost the ability to kind of dissect the technology is really, in a large part, what Make Magazine's about. It's kind of giving that back to the technically minded, the geeks of us. Can you tell us a little bit more about your kind of mission for Make Magazine?
Excuse me?
Can you tell us a little bit more about your mission for Make Magazine? Like, what's the driving force behind it?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, the whole idea about Make is to become comfortable with and have fun with and make more useful the technology in your life. And that could be, you know, just making things from scratch, like a radio out of parts that are probably already in your kitchen, to, converting highly sophisticated consumer electronics that aren't meant to be opened and, are glued shut or have tamper-proof screws. We want to show people that, you know, no matter how complex a piece of technology is, it's possible to make it better and make it more useful for you. And so that's basically our mission, you know. And also, we have just found that it's really fun to use your hands to do things. Surfing the internet is great. All the information on there, it's enjoyable. It's interesting writing programs. Writing your own websites, but when you actually use your hands to make physical things and make mechanisms, there's a special joy in that that can't be duplicated by any other kind of activity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kind of celebrate that and show people all the different ways that they can do it and, you know, projects that will inspire them to do things on their own.
I mean, like a software hacker, they collect software tools, that sort of thing. Are you finding yourself collecting hardware?
Yeah, you know, I slowly am building up more and more things. You know, a lot of times I'll see things that other people review in the magazine or mention on the Make blog. Right now I'm putting together a Nixie Tube clock kit, and something that's been really helpful is a is something that I think sometimes is called a third hand. It's a soldering little
clippers kind of thing on robot. Yeah, like a little freestanding.
Yeah, it's got like
clippers.
Little ball and socket articulated joints and alligator clips on the end and a magnifying glass.
What was the clock you're talking about that you're building?
Oh, a Nixie Tube clock.
What is it?
Nixie tubes are vacuum tubes. You've probably seen them before, and there are filaments inside that have the characters from 0 through 9 on them.
Right, and they brighten up.
Yeah, and so they glow this beautiful warm orange glow. And that was the way that, you know, digital readouts used to be created in old technology. You know,
not the most efficient heat use of electricity in the sense that of heat loss and everything. You're actually heating up a filament like a low light bulb.
Yeah,
that has that is drawn like a character. You know, 1 through 0. But it does have a really wonderful effect. So you're making a clock out of those.
Excuse me.
You're making a clock out of those. Just
yeah,
a
clock.
Why? I mean, you could go buy a clock for $1.50.
Oh, sure. That's, you know, but if you buy something and, you know, yeah, clocks are very cheap. You could buy one. But then you don't really know anything about that clock and you don't have a sense of ownership. But when I'm finished with this clock and if it actually works and I get, you know, the bugs out, every time I look at that clock and to see what time it is, I'll feel proud of that, you know. Anytime you do something like that, you have a story behind the technology, and it makes you feel better about the stuff you have around you, that you have invested some of your time and effort into it. In today's throwaway culture, it's a lot easier to just chuck something and buy something. Like, actually, yesterday, I had a DVD player, VCR player combo, and the DVD part of it broke.
Right.
And I was thinking, you know, what can I do about this? The easiest solution was for me to just get rid of it. And last night I bought a new set, you know, a new combo unit for about $80.
Right.
You know, but if I actually had taken the time to try to fix it and repair it, it would have taken hours and hours.
And assuming you could, really, because it could have just been
true.
A processor that you don't even know what it is because there's no schematic on there. And
but if there's something that you actually can fix,
do it.
Do it, because I think that you'll really appreciate.
There's a bit of a this kind of this desire, really, for old technology you can fix. I used to fix pinball machines as a hobby. And in the 70s, in the mid-70s, like 75, all the pinball manufacturers started using processors on their systems. Before that, it was a whole bunch of gears. They're very cool to play with. The pre-70s ones, or pre-74, are really fun to play with because you can see, you can actually trace every way the electricity runs. You understand the clock works. It really is a mechanical device that happens to use electricity. But in the newer ones, little, you know, it was just a control board with a whole bunch of wires going to it. And if there's something wrong with it, you couldn't do anything. That idea that the older technology was more playable and, of course, probably more expensive, it still resonates with me.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's a lot to be learned from older technology because, you know, it is easier to figure out what's going on when you open up the case. And also, the components in it are valuable for modern projects. We ran an article recently where a guy explained how he goes around to garage sales or even dumpster dives for 1970s consumer electronics.
Yeah.
Right before you know, integrated circuits took off and surface mount components and stuff, and he would show how you could take a you know, printed circuit board and get the potentiometers and the resistors and the transistors off of those boards.
These parts that are getting more and more expensive because people are using surface mount stuff that's not really meant to be used by the human hand.
Yeah.
So you're seeing a real loss in this. You know, I had to show that article to my wife so I could argue in favor for the keeping the old stereos and stuff that I have in the garage. But the trick that he had, which I really liked, is once you have that radio and you know you're not going to use the radio again, take the components out and put them in a storage bin. So that way, it's raw materials. It's not an albatross you've got sitting in your floatable garage.
Yeah, exactly. And it was amazing, you know, seeing how much he was able to scavenge out of like an old clock radio or something like that. You know, the speakers on there, all the different components on there are, you know, a small transformer. That kind of stuff is gold for projects.
Well, especially when you're doing a project like making a tube clock. I want to talk about some of the things you have in the magazine. Some of these things are a little overwhelming for the average person that you know, they did some science and maybe some electronics in high school and then haven't touched it since then, but are still interested in the physical. Maybe they do other things like woodworking or pottery or something where they're very good with their hands. One of the things you've got in this is LED throwies. Can you explain this?
Oh, sure. That's one of our easier projects. And it just involves an LED light-emitting diode, a watch battery, and a small round magnet, powerful magnet, and some tape. And you just tape the leads of the LED on either side of the watch battery, making sure that you've got the polarity correct. Otherwise, it won't light up. And then you wrap some tape around the contacts, the leads and the battery, and then you attach the magnet and wrap another layer of tape, and then you can attach that LED to any metal surface that's magnetic or that a magnet will stick to, and so you can throw them, you know, up on iron girders or something, and if you do a whole bunch of them, they look really cool at night.
How long do the LEDs last on one of these batteries?
They'll last, probably a week or so.
Wow.
You can make it longer if you add a resistor, but then it becomes a little more
complicated.
Complex.
So what's the cost of the materials to make one of these?
If you get them in bulk, they're $1 or less.
It's interesting. It's like it's kind of antithetical to what Make is about, the idea of not wasting, about reusing all this. And then these things are basically... the LEDs are cheap, these little batteries are cheap, and magnets are cheap, so put some tape around them and throw them places. But it is kind of this enjoyment of the physical, you know, of actually moving and modifying atoms instead of just electrons. So it's very appealing to me, the idea that a very simple product like this. I got to get up a pack of these things and play with my son, who
would love
it. Yeah, it's
fun. At the Maker Faire, we had a huge table with tons of raw materials to make these, and it was one of the most popular things, and we had a big school bus. It was actually this group called the Graffiti Research Lab, and they painted a big bus black so that the lights looked really cool when you threw them against the bus. And my three-year-old was making these things and throwing them on the bus, and she was having a great time. And it's become a springboard of inspiration. You know, now people are working on solar-powered versions of these LED throwies so that during the day they build up a charge, and then at night, so that way they'll last a lot longer. And some people are even working on wind-powered versions of these.
That's great.
It's really cool.
You have whole articles speaking on strange power sources for things. The rodent-powered nightlight, which is, I guess, kind of one of these throwies, but instead of a battery pack, you use a wheel that a rodent would run in.
Oh, yeah, that's just a fun way to
kind of show off how electronics work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's a neat thing. You're just taking advantage of something that just happens normally. If you have a hamster or a gerbil, you know those little animals will run in those wheels for hours and hours every day. And so it's fun to just make them turn on a little light.
Yeah. Well, can you, there's one that in here that seems like something that everybody actually wants, especially in Santa Cruz Mountains. The spider rifle, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, the spider sucker rifle. Yeah, that's cool. It's just made of PVC tubing and one of those cans of compressed air that you use to clean keyboards or camera lenses or something like that. And you put it together, and it looks like some kind of, you know, like Star Wars classic era rifle or something that a stormtrooper might have. But what happens is you put the, when you get close to a spider or a bug, you pull the trigger, and the blast of air creates a vacuum that sucks the bug into a little chamber. And then, you know, if you want to be nice, you can go outside into your garden and unscrew the cap and deposit the bug, which doesn't get hurt in the sucking process.
Where can you buy one of these?
You got to make it.
Yep.
See, there's so much potential here for...
Yeah, that's a product right
there. That's a product right there, yeah.
And basically, you grab some PVC, basically some PVC, some glue, and a can of compressed air, and you don't have to touch insects again or catch them in the cup and just go... Pfft. Now, I'm assuming that sometimes the insect gets hurt. I mean, is it a pretty violent thing or not? You've played with one?
Well, you know, it makes a whooshing sound, but there's no... It's not a violent thing. It happens quickly. You know, the poor little bug is clinging, you know, to the surface of the wall as tightly as it can, but it's no match for the powerful vacuum that you create. But there's no bang or explosion or anything like that.
All right, let's, you know what? Oh, gosh, I gotta do some business. Will you stay with us for asking people to call in?
You bet.
Great. So if you'd like to call in, Rick Philman awaits your call with questions or comments. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com, and Business with Pleasure is in Scotts Valley. This program is also supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Miles Elam and John Tracy. And on the phone, editor-in-chief of Make Magazine, Mark Fraunfelder. We're here to take your calls and questions about technology. If you'd like to talk about Make or about little projects, please do so. If you'd like to ask us questions about technology that you're just stumped on, like, you know, why your hard drive doesn't work, we're here for that, too. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org. KOSP's 30th annual radio auction is now behind us, and we'd like to sincerely thank all the businesses and individuals who contributed to this successful event. To make arrangements for pickup of your auction items, call Jane at KOSP 476-2800, and if you want to use that number now, call us up, and Rick will pipe you on air, 476-2800. All right, I want to go ahead and go on with more things from Make Magazine, because I love this magazine. I wish I had more time to do all these things. Let's talk a bit about RFID. Do you mind, Mark?
No, that sounds good.
What is it?
RFID is short for radio frequency identification, and basically what it is a small component, very small, that you can attach to anything, to packages, to a keychain. You could even implant it under your skin. And when it comes within range of a scanner, that scanner will pick up the unique ID number. This is just a string of characters. And that data that the scanner picks up can be sent to a computer and looked up in a database. It's commonly used for lost pets. They'll implant a little glass ampule inside of, in the neck of a cat or something like that. And if the cat's lost, the animal control people can pass the scanner over the animal, and that ID number will be linked to a database telling you who owns the animal.
And that's one of the earlier adoptions of it. They've become so cheap now that there's a lot of... Well, they're used in Walmart for shipping and such. They're not used at the consumer level, but the boxes in large stores like that, that they actually ship between stores, if you will, have tags on them. So the warehouse is all run by RFID. Instead of barcodes, it's a little simpler. You can do it at a distance. You don't have to line things.
Yeah, but you don't have to, if the scanner range is a few feet, you know, you don't even have to get feet, you know, you can just get near the box instead of looking for where the barcode is or something like that. makes it a lot easier. So, you know, the you could put these in credit cards or all sorts of things. I mean, there's some kind of scary implications from a privacy standpoint that people have to be careful of. And, you know, some of the applications are interesting and somewhat alarming to people. There are people who have actually voluntarily had RFID chips implanted in their hands or their arms, and then they have an RFID scanner on their door of their house or office, so they don't need a key. They just walk up, put their hand near this pad, the scanner, and it throws the lock, the bolt of the lock, and the door opens for them.
And when they swing by scanners at Walmart, Walmart sees that ID as well.
Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah, so there's this whole draconian thing that kind of comes up when you talk about these small identification things that you can't actually see. Well, you can see them if you find them, but they can be hidden inside a product pretty well. And one of the things, the article that I really like about, is a whole discussion about how you can buy a scanner and build a very cheap device and find out what things actually have. And because of the security model, which almost is non-existent, and the ones that do have a good security have been cracked at this point, you can find out what products in your home might actually have these tags.
And it's not
hard to build.
Yeah, it's not hard to build. A company called Parallax, in conjunction with one of our frequent contributors, Joe Grand, has created an RFID experimentation kit. It's pretty inexpensive. I think it's under $100. And it lets you experiment with RFID. You can build applications that have chips in them, and the scanner can be combined with any kind of microcontroller kit. So you could do all sorts of interesting applications. You know, you could put a little RFID chip on your cat's collar, for instance, and when your cat enters and exits the little pet door, you could have the comings and goings of the cat monitored on your computer and logged, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned RFID tags, that some people have actually put them in themselves. And to some degree, this is an art form as well. It's a statement about society. But one of the other things that people are doing is body mods. You have a little article about a couple modifications. I was telling Sean about one last night, because both Sean and Miles use glasses, and you rarely see them without their glasses on. But there's a gentleman in your article, in your magazine, that he solved the problem of having glasses in a weird way. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, yeah. So this guy has actually pierced the fleshy part of the bridge of his nose, right between your eyes. You can feel you have some kind of soft flesh there. It's not cartilage. And he put a little kind of a barbell piercing through there, and on each end of the barbell is a small magnet. And what he does then is he has separate lenses, and each lens has a little magnet on it, and you just attach the lenses, one lens on one magnet, the other end on the other magnet, and then the glasses are just basically stuck there on the bridge of his nose, so he doesn't have the little parts that go over your ear.
Or the little part that connects the two glasses together, the bridge, doesn't exist either, or it's in his head.
Right, the bridge is already,
mounted.
But as a person who wears glasses, I'm looking at this picture here, and it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy. it's interesting, because I have a lot of friends that have piercings. Piercings are pretty common. I think I got my ear pierced when I was a young kid, and wearing wearing a piece of jewelry between the eyes right there, that's not that uncommon. But the idea of using it as a functional thing, rather than just decorative, for some reason it enters a new realm for me of oddness and kind of coolness. Would you do it? Do you wear glasses, Mark?
Well, I do wear glasses, but I really like the glasses that I have. They're just like Ray-Ban sunglasses that I've had just turned into clear lenses. And I don't know. I don't know if I would do it, but I also am too afraid to have laser surgery on my eyes too, and that's kind of an interesting to look at. What is more invasive, really, having laser beams beamed into your eye,
burning parts of your eye,
or to put a little hole through the bridge of your nose that you know, once you take the piercing out, you almost, you know, you really can't see it very well at all. And so, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think one of the people's negative reaction is because it's just a new idea to a great deal. But, you know, I could easily see this as being, you know, imagine if this has been around for 100 years, people would think nothing of it being unusual.
Sure. Well, here's another body mod that you write up in the same segment. And this is about adding another sense to the human body.
Oh, yeah. This is a really interesting. Some people are getting little tiny magnets implanted into one of their fingertips, right? And then the magnet is kind of nestled in a nerve-rich portion of the fingertip. And what this does is it lets you develop a new sense so that you can actually tell, for instance, if a cord, like a 110-volt AC cord, is live or not. You can start to feel electromagnetic energy. You can tell if a motor is running in a machine because you actually start to feel it. I don't have, you know, a magnetic implant, so I don't know what the feeling is. But the people who have these implants can now, you know, say that they have, to some degree, you know, been able to sense electromagnetic.
Yeah.
Well, it's turning people into sharks.
Into what?
Into sharks. Sharks have that.
Can
sense
they
electronic
do.
Impulses in water. That's,
you know,
how they find their prey.
It's interesting because I'm the kind of person that everybody I've talked to in the last week after reading this article, I've told this about because I think it's so cool. And I'm kind of tempted to get one or multiples because the more you get, the more sensitive you are. And I was kind of just talking about how it's adding another sense to the body. You can actually have electromagnetic sense, and that's a new sense for the human body. And wow. And then realize that, no, actually, it's not a new sense because you can pick up. If anybody's familiar with a traditional CRT television, after it's turned off, right after it's turned on, you can bring your hands up to it. You can feel the static electricity. That is electromagnetic sensing, and it's by touch. So your body already has the ability to sense electromagnetic waves. This just does it a lot more clearly and helps you. It's an enhancement. It's kind of like wearing glasses for that
sense.
Are
you feeling that off the CRT? I thought you were just feeling the static electricity, the charge, the hairs on your hands.
But you do feel the electromagnetic. You can feel it. You can put your hands up to it and actually feel the
But I'm saying, like, aren't you feeling the effects of it, not the actual event itself?
Yeah, but isn't that what a sense is? I mean, I can tell you whether something has a charge sometimes, and if you have this little thing, you can talk about whether it has alternating current.
Right,
it's still sensing electromagnetic waves.
No, but there is a difference, though, between sensing something directly and having a proxy for it. And that's what this is translating electromagnetic energy.
Are you going to lunch today after the show with us?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's continue this discussion off here.
You know, I think if you had this thing, you just wouldn't put your cell phone in that hand because it'd drive you crazy.
As it rang, you'd be like, I'm going to go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Leon, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hello, Leon. What's your question about your Dell computer?
Actually, I was working on, this kind of goes back to what you guys were talking about earlier about disposable electronics.
Yeah.
I was working on a friend's computer, and I want to call it the AV port. It's the port where the monitor plugs in on the back.
Let's call it a VGA port. Go on.
VGA port. There we go. I don't know how they did this to it, but it looks like somebody took a screwdriver to it or something and just broke it off, basically. So I opened up the whole tower and looked inside, but it basically just attaches right onto the board.
Oh, onto the motherboard?
Is that a replaceable part at all? Because then
I need a new motherboard.
I recommend
it was a paperweight at this point.
You just get a video card.
Yeah, it's a pretty simple.
You probably have an AGP slot that's empty. I would just get a video card and use that AGP slot.
If it's an older machine, you've got a PCI slot. And if it's a really old machine, you've got an ISA slot. The point is that there's multiple extension slots on the motherboard, and one of those you can plug a video card.
If it's a white slot, it's most likely PCI. If it's a dark brown slot, it's most likely
AGP.
AGP.
So, and if it's black, then get a new computer.
All right.
There you go.
Because you probably have an XT case and not a... Okay, anyway.
you guys are way past me at this point. I just
But you don't need... What happened was the onboard video port is broken.
Okay.
But
okay.
Most motherboards have support for third-party video
cards.
The
thing that's weird about this is that that connector that was actually on the motherboard, soldered on probably, and then came through the front, and you actually plugged the cable into and screwed it in, that thing breaking off is weird to me because it couldn't probably get out of the case. It's probably still stuck in the case loose.
Right, no, it is in the case, but when you try to plug it in, it just pushes back into the case.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so what
I ended up doing is I took my finger and held it in place on the other side. Yeah.
So the solder points have dislodged on this thing. But this component is a through-hole component, which means you could re-solder this not that hard. You pull the motherboard out, make sure it's decharged. I would pull the battery off the motherboard too, but this is a lot of work, and it's not exactly worth it if you're not comfortable with soldering.
I've done a lot of soldering all with different kinds of electronics, not with computers. I've never soldered on a computer.
Solder that thing, just do it. Just be careful and do it.
I mean, at this point, he's got a paperweight, so I figure you might as well make it worse.
Of course, you could spend $24, get a new video card, and the computer's working fine. You don't have to mess with it.
Oh, okay.
But right, you could solder it.
I might consider that as well.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
You bet.
So yeah. I know Mark would pull out his soldering iron in an instant, right?
Mark, would you?
Pull
out your soldering iron to fix a motherboard component that fell off?
You know, I'm probably not as much of a maker as the people in the magazine.
You're a writer.
I consider myself to be like an art critic, and the makers are the artists.
Yeah.
I try, but I'm
You're actually a lot like our
editor in chief. Yeah, didn't have time.
You didn't really do all that. You also used to be the editor at Wired.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's great. Oh, it's really cool.
Sean is an old Boot magazine and Maximum PC magazine editor.
Cool.
Yeah, I still read Wired online. Good articles.
You don't buy the mag?
If it's in front of me, I'll read it.
I don't do Wired, but I do make. I think makes a good.
There's so much stuff on the internet now. I really don't look at mag.
Yeah, I do most of my reading online as well. I use a Palm OS device.
Yeah, me too. I use a Treo phone, and it.
Oh, cool.
It's great,
I just download. If I see an interesting article, I just copy it onto my Palm device and then read it, at night with the backlight on when I'm in bed. And that's basically I'm putting together my, daily magazine newspaper.
Anyone that's got a cell phone, a Palm-based device, Windows CE, there's a software called Avantgo, AVANTGO. It's free, and you can subscribe to news feeds on your portable device. Sync.
Yeah, it's excellent.
And that's how I get all my news and stuff. But what I want to ask you is Make Magazine is also available online. You make all your articles available through subscription-based.
That's right. Yeah, if you subscribe to the magazine, then you have automatic access to the digital edition, which has, it's basically the entire magazine in a PDF-style format.
I didn't even know that. I got
to
see that.
Email complete articles to your friends. There's I think there's some kind of limit, like maybe five articles, five friends now, per article.
Can you get a reduced?
But anyway.
Oh, really? Can you get a reduced rate if you don't get the print mag?
If you don't get, I don't know.
I think that's a great idea. Also, the printing out one of these, because a lot of these are like instructions on how to make things, but you don't really want your Make magazine in your shop with solder and everything. But it's cool. You can print out one of the instructions and then, use that as your template and take notes and everything.
Yeah, definitely. That was kind of the idea.
Please feel free to call in, ask our guest questions. We lost John, who I was just about to get to him, about magnets and fingertips. We can get maybe more about John if you call back. If you'd like to call and ask us questions, please do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we are checking our email, right, Geeks? Miles?
We are now.
Oh, right, good. send us email. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And I bet John's calling back right away, so we'll take him in just a second. Mark, I put a whole bunch of stickies all over the mag to ask you questions. Let me see which one I want to talk about. Oh, yeah. So building robots, home robots, for years I've been interested in building robots. I think I've built some things that are halfway there, and played with robots. And in my job, I help people out with electronics of that sort. But one of the things about robots that always gets me is this idea that, to make a really interesting robot, to make it more than an RC car, you want it to do stuff on its own. But to do that, you've got to have a lot of procedural code, or at least that's how most people think. And therefore, you need a processor. And getting a processor and powering that, it starts to become a very complicated project. But there's this whole kind of movement to get away from the processor side to some degree and do beam robots. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Beam robots are, like, really cool, especially for hobbyists, because they're inexpensive and fairly easy to build. And there's a huge, huge community online that can support you in that and get suppliers and things like that. But basically, the idea is kind of started with MIT's Rodney Brooks, who started thinking of robots in a different way. Typically, you know, a complicated autonomous robot was designed so that it had kind of a model of the world around it inside the robot, so that, you know, you use a lot of computing power and memory for the robot to have a model of what a room looks like and then learn how to navigate around it. Then Rodney Brooks said, well, no, why don't we just have it, you know, the robot not have such a complex brain, but just react to events that it senses. So if it bumps into something, then it makes a decision what to do. If it comes in contact with moisture, what does it do? If it comes in contact with a source of light, what does it do? And that greatly simplified things. And then a little later, a guy named Mark Tilden, who was inspired by Rodney Brooks' direction of robotics, took it even a step further and said, you know, we really don't need digital circuitry to do this. Why not just use analog circuitry, just, you know, capacitors and transistors and resistors, and see what happens then? And we just make them extremely simple. So he started making these kind of insectoid robots. They look like bugs or you know, even some of them look like viruses or something. Super simple, and they would just sense something and then act on them. And that was kind of the birth of Beam Robotics. And Beam is an acronym for biology, electronics, aesthetics, and mechanics. And so now people are building these really cool robots that, you know, will, like, its goal is to find a source of light, you know, like light streaming through a window, and it will absorb it with a solar collector into a capacitor, and as soon as there's enough of a charge in the capacitor, it'll start to hobble around and walk around. So we have a couple of Beam Robot do-it-yourself projects in the latest issue of Make. And
you even have, I mean, you show some, you have an article, but you also have a whole section about how to make one, or a couple, I think. And you really need to be able to, you know, heat up solder, but that's about it.
Yeah, that's really simple, and, you know, you can scavenge components out of, you know, things like old tape recorders, VCRs. I haven't actually thrown away my VCR. Maybe I should see if I can get the motor out of that.
I think you should, yeah.
Gears and things like that. Or you can go to a place called solarbotics.com, and one of the Beam pioneers, a guy named Dave Frinkew, has sells kits to make different robots. And they're very nice kits, and he does a great job with them, and he's an author of several Beam Robotics books. And that's an excellent place to start if you're interested in making robots.
And I got to say, other than, you know, besides buying a $20 Radio Shack, you know, RC car, it makes sense if you got a kid that's interested in that kind of thing to get a kit and a soldering iron, because you're starting to make stuff, and that's pretty cool.
I like the Panzeroids.
What are the Panzeroids?
Yeah. You actually buy Panzer tank models, and you fit them with these beam components, and they seek each other out.
That's very cool. All right, I'm going to go ahead and take some calls from Santa Cruz. Paul, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Hi, guys. You piqued my interest when you were talking about that little bug sucker.
Yeah.
And, you know, my daughter is deathly afraid of spiders and wakes me up at 3 in the morning when she's got a little spider in her room. And I'm thinking, if we make this together, she'll have the means to just reach up and zap it without worrying about it. And then I don't have to run to the kitchen and get a container.
the only thing about this bug sucker thing is that if you fire it and you suck up an insect and it gets inside the canister, and you just let it sit in there, it'll crawl back up. So there's a bit of a...
Maybe make a trap door for it.
Yeah. You can...
A modification for someone to come up with is a one-way valve.
Yeah, or a quick detach, something that once you detach the canister, it closes up, and then you can go take it and shake it outside or something.
What kind of diameter are we talking about with the PVC? Half inch, three-quarter inch?
Yeah, I think it's a half inch.
Is there a drawing or a suggestion online where I could kind of see how it was constructed?
You could pick up the latest version of Make magazine at any store and learn about it.
Make number 6.
And it's in there?
Yep. Yeah, yeah. It's got awesome. The whole spider rifle. It's
That's what it's called, spider rifle.
Opening right now. And it has instructions on how to do it. You cut the half-inch PVC pipe into 4 lengths, 18 inches, and go through. I'm not going to repeat it completely because then breaking copyright. But it looks pretty cool. And there's an animation of the spider rifle in action at mslworks.com.
MSLWorks?
MSLWorks.com. But Make Magazine has an amazing website. I highly recommend it. You go to Geeks.
Great.
Or actually, just go to Make Mag. What is it, Make Magazine, Mark?
Makezine.
Makezine.
Makezine.com. And then there is a link on there about something about magazine. And if you look on issue 6, volume 6, you can see a link to the spider rifle.
Excellent. Well, hey, thanks for the great idea, guys. I can't wait to work with my daughter on this thing. And we'll figure out a way to
let us know
keep
how it
the
goes.
Bug and engage.
Send us an email to Make if you...
Yeah, if you make
it,
yeah, do. And especially if she's, like, involved, take some pictures and send it to Make. They'll put it on the blog. It's very community-based.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Have a good time.
Bye-bye.
We're going to go to another call. Robin from Corralitos, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Robin.
Yes.
Yes, what's your question?
Well, my computer has just started recently turning itself off after about 10 minutes. And when it does that, it just tries to restart, but it won't fully restart.
I love Miles' solution to this. Go outside, enjoy the fresh air. I think he said that once on the air. Just love that idea. Ah, it's time. But every 10 minutes doesn't make a very functional computer.
That's true.
Is it a Windows machine?
It is.
Well, I was going to suggest something, but that's not it.
After 10 minutes, it just shuts off.
Yeah, or sometimes less.
Is it a blue screen, or does it actually shut down?
It shuts down completely. Like as if somebody pulled the plug.
Have you opened the case up and looked inside yet?
Yes.
Are the fans working?
Yes. And I've even left the side off and put another fan, you know, like a household fan on it, just in case it needed more ventilation, but that doesn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah, that's not really going to make a difference. Well, are the parts really hot? Have you
No, there doesn't seem to be any heat in there.
What kind of system is it? Do you know what kind of processor it is?
It's an Athlon 2000 Plus from a couple of years ago. It's got about a gig of memory. 266.
And it was working fine up until when?
Like, I don't know, a month ago maybe.
And how long was it working for, okay?
Oh, 3-4 years?
Yeah, wow.
So I'm wondering if it's maybe like a memory module or something?
That's a possibility.
Memory usually goes bad within the first 30 days, or it never goes bad.
Well, you know what? I think we're not going to be able to help you out on this, but if you can compose an email within this amount of time.
I think it'd be a heat issue, though. You send an email to the geeks, and we can help you.
It's probably
there's
heat.
A lot of little things you can try.
Okay.
Something you might want to do is pull the heatsink fan off the CPU and wipe away the thermal grease and reapply it. Make sure it's spread evenly and there's better contact with the top of the CPU.
Robin, thank you very much for the call. Sorry to hang up on you, but we are running out of time, as we do every week on Geek Speak. Our guest today, Mark Fraunfelder, is the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine. He's written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, LA Weekly, Wired, and Playboy. He's also the author and illustrator of 3 books, The Happy Mutant Handbook, Mad Professor, and The World's Worst, which I got to see. So co-founder of the popular Boing Boing web blog, which is a wonderful site, boingboing.net, I think. Anyway, go to geekspeak.org and find the
And that software we mentioned was Avantgo, AVANTGO.com.
And it is also on the website, geekspeak.org, right now for today's show. The geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, thank you all for participating in Geek Speak.
Thank you, Lau.
And thank you for listening to Geek Speak. And to those that called in, thank you for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kusp.org.